May it please the court, James Crochel on behalf of the appellant Toreen Lombard. I'd like to take approximately 7 minutes at this point. Mr. Feld will take the remaining three and save five for rebuttal. The Colorado Supreme Court in the Lombard case at pages 572 and pages 573 of its opinion stated that Sanborn Western Camp would have had actual or constructive knowledge of a dangerous condition on its property if three things were established. First, that the building code was a safety code. It's undisputed that was established at trial. Second, that Sanborn Camp had an obligation to read or know the building code. That was undisputed at trial. They signed numerous building permits saying that they would build in compliance with the code. And third, that the ladder which accessed this loft was in violation of the building code. However, the trial court in this case failed to instruct the jury to that effect. An instruction was submitted that if you find that the building code was in effect, that Sanborn knew or should have known of the provisions of the building code, and find that the latter was in fact a violation of the building code, you must find that the defendants had actual or constructive knowledge of a dangerous condition on their property.
The Supreme Court didn't say that negligence per se, which you argue in your brief, could be used to establish actual knowledge.
I disagree. Page 572 to 573, Justice Martinez specifically breaks down the argument onto two issues. One is notice. He said notice is established by showing the building code is a safety code, the defendant knew or should have known of the code, and that the latter violated the code. He left open the question of whether it was reasonable or unreasonable as a matter of law or failed to comply with the code when he discussed that aspect of the case. So I think he broke the argument down into two aspects in the appellate opinion. One on notice, which he concludes at page 572, 573, and then he goes on to talk about the second aspect of the statute, the failure to take reasonable steps to protect against a dangerous condition. And he says that isn't before the court, but it's clear that the code is some evidence of that. It may also be an issue of liability per se, but that's not before us.
Counsel, are you arguing an appeal that any violation here did establish liability per se?
I'm establishing that a violation of the building code, if the defendant knew or should have known about it, establishes notice, and that's the thing that the jury found it did not, that there was no notice in this case. We're also arguing that the court should go and look at this issue, and that issue is, can you reasonably violate a safety code?
Well, it seems to me that in any safety code, like a building code, you have provisions that deal with safety matters, but to different degrees. That is, failure to comply with a particular provision may create a unreasonable danger to people, but failure to comply with another may not. I mean, it may be there for safety reasons, but the chances of an injury are very small. Why shouldn't that be left up to the jury to decide rather than saying any violation is simply negligence per se?
Well, liability per se, the first issue is notice, and the law is that the defendants knew or should have known what the law is. The second issue becomes, even on an issue of liability per se, the legislative body has established what the standard of conduct is. But this case goes beyond that. This case goes to the fact that the court denied other instructions which would have allowed the jury to find as a matter of fact that the defendants knew or should have known.
But counsel, it seems to me your argument in the brief is not that. It's that the jury should have been instructed that as a matter of law, that they were liable, negligent per se, if they knew of this provision or should have known of the provision, and they violated it.
That's one of our arguments. And we don't believe that you can articulate a basis upon which a reasonable person would say that there is a basis to reasonably violate a safety code. Now, there is a jury instruction 9:15, which we tendered to the court along with 9:14, that explains exactly when, as a matter of law, the failure to follow a statute is reasonable. The judge was given both of those, 9:14, on reasonableness, and 915, when going away from the statute or acting contrary to the statute is reasonable, and the jury should have been properly instructed. The conduct here is reasonable. The reasonable failure to take reasonable steps, just as it is in a negligence case. But the judge went beyond that. He failed to give the jury an instruction that the duty to comply with the building code was non-delegable, which is clearly the law in Colorado under Lombard, under Springer, under Kidwell. That instruction was tendered, and the court refused it. It's important in this case because part of the defense's argument was, well, the building code imposed it. Well, if it's non-delegable, it doesn't matter. Not the building code, the building department approved it. If the building department approved it, that doesn't matter if the responsibility to comply with the code is non-delegable. Furthermore, they had an architect or designer, Mr. Pernish, who was not an officer, agent, or employee of the corporation, who put them on notice with a set of blueprints in 1990 that this loft was not, or these lofts were not to be used as sleeping areas. He specifically designated them as storage space. And the importance there is that under the building code, storage space, the testimony was, could be accessed by a ladder, but habitable space under the building code could not be accessed by a ladder. The jury was not given an opportunity to see those blueprints, even though they were introduced, and they were to, as the defendant described it, units identical or nearly identical to the one in which Mrs. Lombard fell. Nor were they instructed that Mr. Parnish was an agent of Sanborn Western Camp. Now, there's an argument here, well, they were told that Mr. Wright and Mr. Sanborn were employees, but Mr. Parnish was neither an employee, an officer, direct, or director. And the jury was instructed that Sanborn had imputed to them was the knowledge of their agents, but they were never told how to determine whether Parnish was an agent. When he, in fact, in blueprints in 1990, said, you can't use this, or you're not supposed to use this loft for habitable space.
You're knocking on the door of 8 minutes. If it was going to be 7:03 and 5.
Counsel, I have a question. I want to follow up on this issue of the non-delegable duty. Right. That kind of begs the question of what the duty is. And as I understand the code, there is a provision, I think it's 106 or something, which allows for what I will inartfully refer to as waivers or variances or alternative ways of doing things. And if the building department decides that it's okay in this particular instance to use a ladder for this space, notwithstanding what the code may say, it seems that might fall under 106. And why isn't that a jury question?
Well, there's two issues. First of all, the jury should have been then allowed to hear that ladders were used to access non-habitable space, and they were not given the 1990 blueprints, nor was plaintiff's expert on plans and plan inspection and architecture allowed to indicate that. And therefore, the jury could have concluded, if that testimony would have been admitted, which was highly relevant, that a certificate of occupancy didn't establish a Section 106 exemption, but merely established that this was to be used as non-habitable space. But the judge took that away by not allowing the 1990 plans in and by limiting expert testimony.
But secondly, they took those plans away or didn't allow those plans in because they were 1990 plans, and the unit here was built under more other different plans that had been approved and didn't show the space as storage space.
That's right, Your Honor. The only plans submitted were a set of 75 plans that were not identical to this unit. There was no plan submitted for the construction of this unit.
I understand that, but there was testimony, was there not, that these were the same kinds of units?
Well, there was testimony that the 1990 units were the same kind of units.
I understand that, but don't we have to go back to when these units were built?
No, we have to go back to when the defendants had notice. And they had notice in 1990 when the other architect put down they were not supposed to be used.
Well, let's inquire. He said he designates them as storage space. That's not the same thing as saying you can't use them for anything else.
Well, you can use it illegally for something else.
But it doesn't say that either. I mean, an architect can draw bedroom on a floor plan, and the homeowner decides, I'm going to use it as a living room.
And it may be a violation of the building code if that bedroom doesn't have a second access, which it's required to do, and it's built unsafely. It can be, you cannot just say, well, he put storage unit on a shed, so therefore we can rent it out. Here, the point is, he put storage that has specific expectations under the building code. But secondly, 106 is a red herring in this case. 106 doesn't give the building department the absolute authority to approve anything it wants. It says that the building department, or somebody can submit an alternate design, but that alternate design has to be, it says the building code requires the building official may approve an alternate design if he finds that the proposed design is satisfactory and the methods, materials, or work is for the purpose intended, at least the equivalent of the prescribed in the code in quality, effectiveness, and safety. And every witness in this case who testified, including Mrs. Sanborn's, the Sanborn's representative, testified that that ladder was not equivalent to a staircase in terms of effectiveness and safety.
Counsel, you've been off the clock for about 2.5 minutes for questions. You're eating into the time you wish to share with co-counsel, or you're about to. You have done so. You said 7 minutes.
Right.
And you're over 7 minutes. So my question is, do you want to continue, or do you want to let your co-counsel have his time? It's up to you entirely.
He wants to some time.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Paul Feld, registration number 11265, on behalf of the Appellate Pueblo School District. And I will, if it please the court, take my time to address a single issue, which is the only issue that we are opposite both the plaintiff and the defendant, and that is the question of whether my client, as a political subdivision of the state, Pueblo School District, is immune from an order of costs. And I believe that in this particular context, a case arising out of the Colorado Workers' Compensation Act, and specifically the subrogation statute 8-41-203, I believe this may in fact be a case of first impression for the appellate court. I've looked and I've not found a case where the court has been asked to interpret the cost section under CRCP 54 or also under CRS 13-16-105.
Let me ask a question.
Your
Honor. You could have just filed a lien on the judgment of this case under your right of subrogation and recovered, could you not?
We could have, Your Honor, but there are
and but you joined initially as a plaintiff and prosecuted the case as a plaintiff.
We did, Your Honor, many years ago.
Huh?
Many years ago, from the beginning.
Right, from the beginning. You've been a direct party in the case, and doesn't that, since you initiated it, put the shoe on a little different foot?
That is the argument of the defendant, Your Honor, and I think that is also one of Judge Colt's bases for saying that we were not immune from costs. But that is why I think this is a case of first impression, and I think, quite frankly, that Judge Colt was in error. He relied on one Supreme Court case, the Ross Miller case, which is a 106 case interpreting Rule 106, which does have a specific provision for the state or the public entity to be liable for costs. In that case, it's particularly the transcripts. And he relied on two cases from this court that dealt with the public entity as a defendant under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. Those were the three cases cited by Judge Colt. None of those are controlling. What is controlling? The default position, according to the Supreme Court, as recently as 2005 in the Farmers Reservoir case, which we cited in our brief, is that absent a specific legislative expression of the legislature's intent to have a public entity, and the Supreme Court talks about the status as a litigant is not what's relevant. So whether you're a plaintiff or a defendant, what's relevant is whether there's an express legislative intent to assess costs against the public entity. The Supreme Court quite clearly, and it cited many cases from this court where they correctly pointed out the Court of Appeals has on occasion affirmed the award of costs against a public entity. For instance, when there's a special statute like the Game and Fish, the Barr case, or under a Colorado governmental immunity case. But they also looked on favor on Court of Appeals cases, such as, I believe it's the Furlong case, Smith versus Furlong, where this court said that award of costs against a public entity is not allowed. They reversed the trial court because there was no specific grant. The court also, the Supreme Court, favorably cited this court's decision in the McFarland versus Gunter case, and I have those citations, but the important thing about the Smith versus Furlong case, which I think Judge Colt overlooked, was that the Supreme Court said that absent an express legislative condition, that a general cost provision, and in Furlong they were looking at 104 because it was the plaintiff's costs. In this case, costs were assessed under Section 105 because it was the defendant was the prevailing party. But the Supreme Court has cited to Court of Appeals cases saying that the general cost provisions are not a sufficient basis to assess costs. There needs to be a specific grant. And under 841-203, which is where my client's cause of action...
Don't worry about the time, counsel.
Where my client's cause of action lies, there is no specific grant of costs against a public entity. I'm not... The court wants me to address the public policies. I will. But the law is, and Farmers Reservoir is the controlling Supreme Court case. It's later than the Court of Appeals cases cited by the defendant and relied on by Judge Colt, and it seems to be on point. I understand it was a water law case, but other than that, there were both public entities plaintiff and public entities defendant in that case, and there were private entities as well. And interestingly enough, in Farmers Reservoir, the Supreme Court reversed the cost judgment against four public entities. I think it was Northland, Thornton, maybe Arvada, but affirmed against the private entities that were in the same legal status as the public entities other than the private versus public. So I'm not saying it may not be fair, it may be a harsh result, but there are good public policy reasons why, especially in this day of budget crises, where a public entity can exercise its legal rights, and if they lose, they are immune from costs unless the legislature says otherwise. And in this case, I think Judge Colt failed to follow the Supreme Court's guidance in terms of a public school district. They should have been immune from costs.
Well, I'm sure you're aware of the defendant's citation of the Turinsky case from 1987.
I recall that.
Division of Employment and Training versus Turinsky.
Right.
Seems to indicate that by taking affirmative action in the case, by appealing, by seeking cert, the political subdivision had waived any immunity for costs.
In Your Honor, I may have this case mixed up with another one. I know there have been cases where the public entity was deemed to have waived their immunity because the court had deemed their action to be, or their defense to be, frivolous. I'm not sure if that's the Turinsky case or not. There's no claim in this case that our claim was not a legitimate, good faith based claim. And I forget the facts of Turinsky, but that may have been under the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act. The point is, under the subrogation statute and the Workers' Compensation Act, there is no specific legislative expression. It's silent. The default position would be the Supreme Court that absent a specific legislative cost simply cannot be assessed against a public entity, whether they are, whatever their position is as a litigant. I know there was a waiver issued raised by the defendant and actually the plaintiff having to do with a stipulation back in 2005. I'm not sure if, and Judge Colt did at least address that in his costs order, and he determined there was no waiver. He did raise the issue that why would they have entered into a stipulation in the first place about sharing costs, if they were immune from costs, but he did not find that the stipulation in question was a waiver on this argument. And I simply indicated to Judge Cole at that time that I wasn't counsel when that stipulation was entered, and in any event, it was limited to a certain agreement with regard to a summary judgment motion, and it was no longer relevant as to trial costs. If that's what you're asking me about this waiver argument, why they entered into that agreement, I don't know. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm either a very poor, have very poor control of the courtroom, or very poor control of my colleagues, or counsel has portioned time in a way that no one is going to be able to live with. So I'm going to give 5 more minutes to the appellant for rebuttal and give the appellee 20. We'll put you back where you started.
Thank you, Your Honors. I may please the court. My name is John Roach, and my colleague at counsel's table is Aaron Nesbitt, and we appreciate very much the time the court has given us today to present defendants' arguments. Plaintiff represented in the opening brief that the three issues on appeal, the rejection of certain tender jury instructions, various evidentiary rulings, and the denial of the motion for a mistrial based on certain defense lawyer comments, are reviewed de novo by this court. With all due respect, plaintiff is mistaken, as all three of these issues are reviewed by this court under the standard of abuse of discretion. In order to receive the extraordinary relief of a new trial, plaintiff must satisfy, of course, a two-prong test. Plaintiff must first show that the trial court committed error, and here show that the trial court committed an abuse of discretion. And then secondly, the plaintiff must show that the purported abuse of discretion deprived her of a fair trial or substantial justice. In other words, that the outcome would have been different absent the purported abuses of discretion. In this case, the basic issue for the jury's resolution was the pure factual one of why plaintiff fell down the stairs. Plaintiff alleged, argued to the jury, that she fell down the stairs, She fell down the ladder because the ladder was unreasonably dangerous, and that is what caused her fall. Defendants contended that the ladder was not unreasonably dangerous and that plaintiff fell because of her carelessness and fault. As you know from reading the record, there was evidence that she descended the ladder with the lights off, without her shoes. She was carrying a book. She was facing away from the ladder. She had pre-existing medical conditions. She testified herself that her hands and wrists were weak. She was the only person in the history of this camp in all of the 44 units who ever suffered an injury from using this ladder. So our argument is, of course, that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in its challenged rulings, but plaintiffs cannot show that even if there was error in this case or there was an abuse of discretion, that the verdict should be set aside and have a new trial because the verdict was in accordance with substantial justice, it was consistent with the evidence, and in fact, plaintiff does not appeal the verdict based on any argument that it was against the weight of the evidence. But you don't have to get to that second prong, Your Honors, because the trial court did not abuse its discretion in this case. For the jury instructions, the trial court had the benefit of direction from the Colorado Supreme Court as to applicable law, and it followed that direction to a T. On premises liability law, the Colorado Supreme Court, in this very case, in the Lombard case, held that a premises liability plaintiff must prove that the defendant knew or should have known of the dangerous condition and failed to exercise reasonable care, that violation of the building code is evidence of, if shown, is only evidence of, is not proof of a failure to exercise reasonable care.
Be that that latter premise goes only to the reasonableness and not to knowledge or notice.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, you said it again.
As I understand counsel's argument, he divides it into two parts. One is a question of notice under the statute of actual or constructive knowledge, and the other is whether or not the action was reasonable. My question to you is the Supreme Court's pronouncement in terms of violation of a statute or an ordinance being notice or being simply evidence of notice, or is it notice itself if the three factors that counsel mentioned are established?
May I answer that this
way? Of course.
Way, the Colorado Supreme Court in Lombard required a plaintiff to show that the defendant knew or should have known of a dangerous condition, and then also instructed that violation of the building code is evidence, not proof, of a dangerous condition, and then also held that a builder who is subject to the building code is presumed to have constructive notice of the violation if he builds in violation of the code. The trial court followed that law to a T, and by instructing the jury that it could find that on the should have known standard, which it did instruct the jury on, and that the violation of the building code is evidence of failure to exercise reasonable care, and by jury instruction 31, the trial court instructed the jury that, quote, all parties are presumed to know the law which applies to their conduct. So my answer to your question is that negligence per se and the kind of arguments they're making with notice is not really the appropriate analytical framework for this court to decide this premises liability claim. The Colorado Supreme Court held that the plaintiff must, and the trial court must instruct the jury that a premises liability plaintiff must show that the defendant knew or should have known of an unreasonably dangerous condition on the premises. The trial court did just that, and the trial court also let the jury know that all parties are presumed to know the law which applies to their conduct, and ignorance of the law is not an excuse to violate the law, so that the jury could find that a violation of the building code here is evidence of a failure to exercise reasonable care. The our view, Your Honors, is that plaintiff's arguments on all of these jury instructions are simply premised on a misapprehension of the Colorado Supreme Court's ruling as to what constitutes a valid premises liability claim and what you must show to prove that. The jury instructions were proper, and the decision of the jury was based on its factual determinations as to unreasonable danger and causation.
Is it your perception of the Lombard decision from the Supreme Court that negligence per se cannot be the sole basis for notice, that the plaintiff must prove more?
My reading of the Lombard decision, the Colorado Supreme Court decision, is that negligence per se is not an applicable concept any longer in claims brought under the premises liability statute. The premises liability statute occupies the field. It has its particular elements. The plaintiff must show that the defendant knew or should have known of a dangerous condition. It can present evidence of that by presenting evidence of a violation of the building code. And it did that here. And the defendant, of course, presented contrary evidence that there was no violation of the building code. As Your Honor pointed out, it was an alternate construction permitted by the state agency pursuant to Rule 106. But even if the jury found that there was a violation of the building code, they were free to determine that that violation did not create an unreasonable condition. In other words, that the ladder here was not unreasonably dangerous.
All right, I want to focus on that point because I don't read Lombard the same way, I got to tell you. Lombard is a summary judgment case. That's how it gets to the Supreme Court. And the court says that violation of the building code is evidence of an unreasonable danger or notice of an unreasonable danger. And in the footnote 6, the court specifically says, we are not deciding in this case whether the failure to comply with the building code is conclusive. It sounds to me like the court was leaving open the possibility that the failure to comply with the building code was conclusive proof of notice of a dangerous condition.
That may be a case, Your Honor, under certain factual scenarios. For example, if the building code required a roof to be of a certain strength, and the roof was not of that strength, everyone agrees with that, and there's pretty much no dispute under the summary judgment standard or otherwise that the roof caved in and injured someone and there was an injury as a result. That in that kind of scenario, there could be a finding, perhaps one of law by the court, perhaps one of fact by the jury, that the violation of the building code in that particular circumstance was sufficient for the plaintiffs to satisfy the elements of a premises liability case. That is not the situation here.
I understand you're saying it's not the situation here, but I guess what I'm having trouble with is how do we determine when that is the situation and when it isn't? Because the court has to make a determination in instructing the jury. And here, the contention is the jury should have been instructed that this was a dangerous condition as a matter of law. Okay, that's the contention. Yeah. Okay, now that's a call the judge has to make. Yeah. Okay, in your hypothetical, the judge has to make the same call, the failure to build the roof to a sufficient level of strength, and he has to make a call. Do I instruct the jury to that effect or not? And, of course, the permutations are endless. There could be any number of violations, and in each of those situations, a court would then have to make a call. Well, do I think it's serious enough? Does it present enough of a danger that I'm going to instruct the jury it's a violation or it's unreasonable as a matter of law or not? So I guess I'm having a little trouble figuring out where do we draw the line?
Well, I think this is...
How does a court do that? Practically speaking.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I think this is the courts have to make those kind of distinctions, for example, on summary judgment motions, like in this very case, determining whether there are issues of fact concerning whether certain violations would result in liability or not. I think the best way I can answer it is limited to the facts of this case. The plaintiff's contention is that having a ladder rather than stairs renders the premises unreasonably dangerous. Now, an unreasonably dangerous is an important term. Of course, a ladder by its very nature has its dangers. Stairs by their very nature have their dangers. People are regularly injured by walking up and down ladders and walking up and down stairs that are in perfect condition. Their contention at trial is that the building code required stairs, and the fact that you had a ladder instead of the stairs rendered the condition unreasonably dangerous. That is a determination that had to be made by the jury. The jury had to determine whether, in fact, this ladder rendered the condition unreasonably dangerous. And the court appropriately instructed the jury that the plaintiff must show that defendants knew or should have known of an unreasonably dangerous condition. In this case, in the end, the jury decided that a ladder was not unreasonably dangerous. And also, importantly, that the ladder was not the cause of the injury. The cause of the injury was plaintiff's carelessness.
The jury didn't make those findings. It just said they didn't know of a dangerous condition, didn't they?
And causation findings as well, Your Honor, that that the ladder was not the cause of what happened here. She was injured, and the jury, that's the whole basis of the case. Why did she fall down the ladder? And one argument on the plaintiff's side was she fell down the ladder because a ladder, just by its very nature, is unreasonably dangerous. This ladder was unreasonably dangerous. And the counter argument by defendant, presented through evidence, was that this ladder was not unreasonably dangerous. It was navigated for decades by numerous people without injury. She's the only person to ever have been injured going down that ladder. The ladder is not unreasonably dangerous and not the cause of her injuries.
Also, I guess I have a bit of a problem. Help me. Generally speaking, there's no question, it seems to me, but what the question of whether a particular condition is unreasonably dangerous is a factual question. But where a legislature has said, in effect, that you cannot build this for safety purposes, how does either the court or the jury second guess that?
Well, I think the answer to that question, Your Honor, is maybe subsumed in the question asked by Judge Jones, that it's a matter of degree relating to violations of a building code. There may indeed, in some scenarios, be violations of a building code, which there's no reasonable argument that such violation did not create an unreasonably dangerous condition and that such violation was not the cause of the injury. That is not this case. When you have a case like this, where a violation of the building code is only evidence of a failure to exercise reasonable care, as the Lombard Court discussed, as the Lombard Supreme Court discussed in this very case, then the jury makes a determination based on all the evidence, including the alleged violation of the building code, as to whether the ladder was indeed unreasonably dangerous and whether, in fact, the ladder was the cause of plaintiff's injury.
Let me ask you this. Are there not violations of the building code which would not create a dangerous condition?
Absolutely.
And there's nowhere in the building code where it requires a ladder to go up to this space that it says the absence of a ladder is a dangerous condition.
That's correct. There's nothing that says that.
Okay. There's nothing that says that a ladder going up to this space is a dangerous condition.
That's correct.
In the building code. Plaintiff put on their case by the use of experts. Wanted three, got two. Testified that this was a dangerous condition. Is that correct?
That's
in their opinion.
Their opinion was that the building code required stairs rather than a ladder. Whether they went on and said that created an unreasonably dangerous condition, I'm not clear about whether that was simply argument made by counsel.
So, absent some notice, the ordinance itself would not give a layman notice, direct notice at least, that having a ladder in that space instead of stairs is a dangerous condition.
Well, let me answer it this way. By a layman, are you referring to the plaintiff or to the defendants or anybody?
Anybody.
Defendant's position is that, basic position, is that the ladder was not unreasonably dangerous. In response to the arguments from plaintiff's experts that the code required stairs rather than the ladder, we questioned that testimony through cross-examination. And that under 106 of the code, a ladder was a permissible alternate construction. So we acknowledge that we are presumed to know the law. Defendants are presumed to know the law. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. Our argument is twofold. One, this was not a violation of the building code. We presented that argument because it's an alternate construction. But secondly, even if it was a violation of the building code to have a ladder rather than stairs, that violation did not create an unreasonably dangerous condition on the premises and did not cause plaintiff's injury.
Let me ask you one question on costs. Ethics Committee of the Colorado Bar issued opinion 104, which I think is cited in the briefs. And in there, they say that if an attorney wants to keep a copy of the file, it should be done at the attorney's expense because the file belongs to the client. Now, your client apparently changed attorneys somewhere in the midst of this process, and your client volunteered to meet the copy expense instead of the counsel having to do it himself. Should that be taxed as a cost?
Your Honor, we think so. for the reasons argued, and the trial court agreed with that. But may I say on costs that just generally on costs that one we rest on the arguments we made in our briefs, but this is really an issue, the cost issue between Ms. Lombard and the school district. We have a cost bond in place where we can recover our costs. They've already been awarded.
I'm asking if you'd be able to recover that cost.
We believe
because they're appealing that cost.
Yeah, we believe so. That we should be able to, we should be able to do that. It was just a necessary cost in terms of the defendant's use of counsel of their choice to present their defense at trial, and that just happens in cases that sometimes attorneys are changed, and that cost was one that we felt was reasonable in order to present the defense at the trial of this case. Your Honor, on the other, just very quickly, on the evidentiary issues and on the motion for a mistrial, which the mistrial motion wasn't argued much, our basic position on those two arguments is that the these were not error. They were a sound exercise of the court's discretion in managing the trial, and the court on the comments about from defense counsel was in the courtroom, saw the jury's reaction, and concluded that those comments had no effect on the jury, and therefore not a basis. It's not abuse of discretion, and certainly not a basis for a new trial that had any effect on the outcome of the trial. Thank you, Your Honor.
Give appellant 6 minutes. We'll get out of here sometime, sir.
Counsel, I know you have some things to say, but I want to ask you a question on the record.
Off the record?
About the record.
Okay.
Pardon me. Was there a specific finding by the jury pursuant to a special interrogatory or check marks on a verdict form to the effect that the plaintiff had not established that the fall from the ladder was the cause of her injuries?
No. It was simply the carry instruction that says, was she injured? If you find she was injured, then go to the second. Did they have reasonable notice? If you find there was reasonable notice, then go to the third. If you find that they didn't take reasonable steps, then did their conduct, was there a violation of their conduct a cause of the injuries? There was no specific instruction, I think, as the court is asking about.
The jury's initial finding was that there was no notice, that they were not on. They did not know, or actually know, or should have known that the ladder was a dangerous condition.
That's correct. And the testimony at trial was that the building code requires a ladder in all cases to access habitable space. There is no exclusion, nothing other than the ladder.
I understand. I'm going to ask you the same question I asked counsel. Does the building code itself say that that's a dangerous condition if you breach it?
Well,
yes or no, counsel?
It does not spell it out.
Doesn't say that, does it, counsel?
No.
With the second question, are there violations of the building code that would not create a dangerous condition?
There could be some violations of the building code which would not create a dangerous condition, but this provision of the building code is for safety purposes. It's not whether you put four nails in the wall or three. It's the testimony of trial was that the code only allows for a staircase to access habitable space, and the requirements of the staircase were developed because, for safety reasons, we have to have a handrail because people slip. We can't have too high of a rise. The steps have to be consistent.
Let me ask you another question. Does the building code say what that is? You have expert testimony that says all that. I understand that. And that testimony is entitled to weight, and certainly entitled to be admitted, and certainly entitled to weight. But my question is, we're talking about laymen. Lay people, the owners and managers and so forth.
We're talking about experts, Your Honor. They agreed to build in compliance with the code. And they undertook the responsibilities of a general contractor.
Well, my experience in dealing with building inspectors and so forth is not on the record, and I'm not going to rely on it. But the fact of the matter is, the building code doesn't say this creates a dangerous condition, nor does it say that those provisions of the code that are intended for safety purposes, failure to comply creates a dangerous condition.
Well, it's a safety code, and it says you're to comply with the code.
What if you had competing experts? One says this is creates a dangerous condition. It is a safety provision. The other one says no, it is not. Is a court supposed to let that go to the jury, or is the court supposed to weigh the credibility of the experts and say, well, I believe him, so I'm going to instruct the jury that it's a dangerous condition as a matter of law?
I think the court would have to determine whether this was a safety issue as a matter of law after hearing the two experts.
Weighing credibility?
No.
I mean, that's...
Is this a safety provision of the code, or is it simply how many nails do you put in?
Well, given that the code doesn't say whether it's a safety provision, as I think we now all agree, and you've just got experts talking about whether it is or not, how can a judge rule as a matter of law whether it is or not? Why? And he has to make a credibility finding.
The same way the judge rules in a traffic case. The violation of the traffic code raises negligence per se.
But
it's unreasonable. The legislature has established what is reasonable conduct.
You're saying every violation of the motor vehicle code creates negligence per se, or are you just saying some do?
Moving violations. Violations that resulted in this accident or injury.
So running a stop sign.
Running a stop sign.
Most people would understand that, right. I think.
And in this case, failing to build a code-compliant staircase. And their comparative negligence argument is the perfect example. You could go up a staircase if you had wrist surgery or done it without a problem. You could go up a staircase in your barefoot, but they say she was negligent to do that. People can go up and down code-compliant staircases safely all the time at night, but they say it's negligent to do it in a partially lit room because this is a ladder, not a staircase. It's okay, you can safely navigate a staircase with a magazine in your hand, and they say it was negligence in this case to navigate a ladder. Section 106 of the building code says if you're going to propose an alternate other than the staircase, you have to establish that it is equally safe to a staircase. And it is the burden of the party seeking the 106 exemption to prove that. And there was no evidence in this case that they got a specific request to do that. All they could say is, well, see, it was approved. But it could have been approved because this was accessing non-habitable space where the public isn't going to gain access.
But to follow your own argument, counsel, it seems to me sort of anomalous that you can have a storage space with a ladder where you know people are going to be going up hauling something. Maybe a suitcase, maybe who knows what. And they're going up and down by ladder rather than go up and down, you know, because they're putting this a storage space. It's okay for a storage space, but not for pedestrians.
Well, because it's the public. When they rent this building to the public, they have to have a place that's safe for the public, not safe for a person who knows the risk or knows of the danger and is specifically aware of it. That's the whole purpose of the building code in public places. Lastly, I'd ask the court to look at page 573 of the Lombard case. There, Justice Martinez says, in sum, Lombard presented sufficient evidence that the alleged code violation provisions were intended to protect the health and safety of the public, and therefore, that their violation constituted a danger. That Sanborn had knowledge of the building code by virtue of acting as its general contractor, having agreed to build in accordance with the code, and that Sanborn knew or should have known because it was responsible to build the units and install the ladder in violation of the code. Thus, Lombard alleges facts that, if true, prove that Sanborn knew or should have known of a danger on the premises.
Purposes of summary.
No, I think they say we allege that. But if we prove those facts, they actually have notice. And then the court goes on to talk about unreasonable failure, which, as I indicated, there's a jury instruction that a jury is entitled to that we submitted when you do not have to follow negligence per se or liability per se.
Thank you, counsel. We thank everyone for their well-delivered, I might add, lengthy arguments, and for their briefs. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.